Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents Elmer Kelton's Sons of Texas series. Performed by Terrence Aselford, Drew Copus, Daniel Stevens, Andy Clements, Elizabeth Jernigan, Thomas Keegan, Joe Brack, Tony Nam, James Konacek, Joseph Thornhill, Yasmin Toison, Michael Glenn, Nick DePinto, Nanette Savard, James Keegan, Christopher Graybill, Bobby Aselford, Tim Getman, David Coyne, Eric Messner, Scott McCormick, M.B. Van Dorn, Michael John Casey, Richard Rowan, Colleen Delaney, Dylan Lynch, Kimberly Gilbert, Nathaniel Perry, Patrick Stratton, and Mort Shelby. Sons of Texas, number 2, The Raiders, part 2. Lewis, Eli Pleasant, and young Zeb Willett returned from watching the Indian village as the sun was covered by boiling clouds. The cool air being whipped up by the approaching storm gave them as much of a chill as the thought of venturing down among the Indians to rescue Zeb's younger brother Daniel. He was being held prisoner by the Indians. Eli and the two younger men had scouted for some sign of just where Daniel was being held. As they related what they'd seen to Andrew's brother Michael, Andrew let Eli and Zeb do the talking. He stood back and watched Michael's face as the old man and the young one described the village. Michael frowned deeply, listening.
Are you sure you can find the right hut? They'll all look alike in the dark.
The one the youngin's in has another behind him, raised way up off the ground. They got food stored underneath. I hear tell they make the young girls sleep up there on the high floor with a ladder taken down so the boys can't get to them. I doubt as it works very good. In my day, it wouldn't have.
It don't matter how dark. I'll know which one Daniel's in. I'll feel it.
Michael gave Zeb a glance that spoke more of sympathy than of belief.
I'd a lot sooner go by seeing than by feeling. Eli, you said those huts look like beehives. They'll buzz like beehives, too, the minute we go in there. We're apt to have the whole tribe down on us before we can get out.
Andrew felt a nervous itching along his backside. A vague idea had come to him as they were riding back along the river. He hesitated to bring it up for fear Michael would automatically reject any idea of his. But perhaps he could plant the seed and let Michael believe the idea had been his own.
Eli, something's bothered me about them grass huts. How can they build a fire inside without burning the place down?
They put the fire right in the middle, with stones around it and a hole in the roof for the smoke to go out. They don't let the fire get too big. One good spark could put them out of house and home in a minute.
Michael's eyes brightened, and Andrew saw that the seed had sprouted. Michael turned away for a minute or so, staring off into the distance.
It just come to me how we can get their attention away from the hut where they're keeping the boy. We'll set off a couple of the huts on the far side. While they're all rushing to try and stop it, we'll run in and grab Zeb's brother.
Seems to me that's what Andy Jackson used to call a diversion.
Miles Nathan stood and walked over to the men.
Whatever you call it, it sounds good to me.
I'm with you, Michael.
Michael frowned at Andrew.
I'm surprised you didn't think of it yourself.
Yeah, I don't have your experience.
Michael looked to the west, where the sun had dropped below the horizon and a heavy cloud was rapidly bringing night's darkness upon the woods.
If it sets to rain in that accidental, fires have to be hard to start.
Andrew turned to the man with the eye patch.
The Reverend, looks to me like it's time you prayed for dry weather.
They waited for full dark. Lightning was flashing to the west when they started. Michael led them out of the timber, but only far enough that they could ride, unimpeded by the tangle of trees and the clutching of briars. They were always near enough to the wood that they could quickly pull back into its protective cover. Andrew worried that the bright flares of lightning might give them away if anyone was alert in the village or guarding his perimeter. Eli tried to ease his mind.
Indians don't seem to ever have caught the white man's liking for guard duty, unless they've got a strong feeling there's an enemy about. Most of the time, they don't bother with setting up a watch. They just turn that over to the dogs and go to sleep.
The men fell silent. Though they rode in a body, each was alone with his own somber thoughts. In a while, they reached the place where the village's horses were loose-herded on an open patch of grassland. Andrew watched for guards and the occasional flash of distant lightning. He saw none, but he knew there must be one or two at least, preventing the horses from straying away in the night. They probably had little thought of attack by an outside enemy.
This thing all started with the Waco stealing horses. It would pay him back good and proper if he was to run away with the whole herd. They'd be worth a fair dollar back in the settlements.
They'd slow us down and get us caught up with, Walker. We're here to get the boy back and nothing else. What's more, if we can get away without having to kill any more Indians, it'll help our chances. Kill one of them and they're liable to hound us all the way home.
Harlan Mann spoke up.
We killed and buried one already, the one that wounded Paul.
They ain't missed him yet. Chances are they'll never know what come of him.
Reaching the river, the riders moved along its south bank until the smell of smoke began to mix with the pleasant hint of rain on the breeze from the cloudy west.
The wind's still on our side. If we're careful, maybe we won't stir up the camp dogs.
I hope that's not a scalp song or something. You don't reckon they're fixing to burn Daniel at the stake?
And I never heard of these Indians doing such as that. If they intended to kill him, they'd have done it at start, like they'd done to your daddy. I expect this is a good place for us to cross the river. Village is right up yonder.
They eased into the water and let the horses drink. Done, they moved up over the north bank and halted. This was very near the spot from which Andrew, Zeb, and Eli had watched earlier. Andrew could make out the vague outlines of many huts. Some had a faint glow from fires built inside, though most looked dark. A few outdoor fires made tiny pinpoints of light. Andrew studied the scene a minute, then pointed.
That's the hut where they had Daniel.
Michael was silent for a time, concentrating his thoughts upon the village.
Where's the door?
It was too dark for him to see that kind of detail.
These huts have generally got two doors, one on the east and one on the west. And the back door faces this side.
Then we ought to be able to go in without having to be exposed to the center of the camp. Now, if somebody could sneak around yonder and touch off a couple of the huts on the far side, it'd draw the attention over that way.
Well, that's a good job for me and Joe.
I'll go and stand guard while they do the honors.
Try not to let anybody see you. It'll be better if they don't realize they've been invaded. Get the fire started, then get back to here. This is where we'll leave the horses.
Michael looked at Zeb Willett.
We don't want to make any mistakes in the dark and find out we've carried off some Indian boy instead of your brother. You want to go with me into the hut?
Zeb nodded grimly.
That's the only way I'd have it. Two won't be enough. I'm going with you.
Michael frowned, but didn't disagree.
Well, that still leaves three of us.
Michael yielded Fairweather a quick, distrustful glance, then spoke to Miles Nathan.
I want a good, responsible man to stay here and hold on to the horses. If any of them was to get away from us, we'd be in a bad fix.
You can depend on the Reverend and me.
Michael didn't seem to care whether Fairweather assented or not.
I will ask the Lord's hand to guide you.
Michael ignored him.
We take that kindly.
What do you want me to do?
You'll go with us halfway and stand guard to make sure nobody cuts us off from getting back to the horses.
Andrew's pulse quickened as Michael dismounted.
All right. Eli, you all get started. We'll wait till the village is in uproar, then we'll go in.
Eli beckoned Yonson Smith with his chin.
Vamanos!
In seconds, the three riders were swallowed up in darkness. Lightning flashed, but Andrew could no longer see them. Michael handed his reins to Nathan. He looked at Andrew and Zeb.
No shooting, unless there's no way around it. We don't want to pull anybody's attention away from the fire.
Andrew could see Zeb's hands visibly trembling as he handed his reins to Fairweather.
Steady. With luck, we'll be away from here pretty soon.
But Andrew could feel his own hand shaking a little, and cold sweat broke on his forehead. He stared at the quiet hut which they had targeted, and he wondered how many people inside might be inclined to fight. He wiped his wet palms against his trousers. Michael gave him a critical study.
Maybe you better stay and help hold the horses.
You won't have to be looking back, wondering where I'm at. I'll be in front of you.
Not too far in front. That's like being by yourself.
Crouching, the three moved away from the river, closer to the edge of the village. Andrew was heartened to see that the dogs barking aroused no particular interest among the villagers. One man stepped out of a hut.
Tecutele!
That Indian's dog stopped barking, but others did not. Michael raised his hand.
Far enough. We'll wait.
The wait seemed an hour long. Andrew began wondering how long it would take three men to circle the village on horseback and start a fire. Zeb was having the same thoughts.
Reckon they got caught? We'd be hearing a lot of excitement. Things are pretty quiet.
Andrew began to wonder if setting one of these grass structures afire might be more difficult than it sounded. Then, on the far side of the village, flames began to lick up the side of a hut, and they burst suddenly atop a second hut nearby. In the glow, Andrew saw people running from the two huts. Against the growing flames, he could see people hurrying in all directions. They poured out of other huts, some running toward the fires and some away. The west wind picked up sparks and then firebrands. A third hut began to burn. Zeb raised up, ready to go. Michael touched his arm.
Wait a minute. We need to allow time for Eli and them to get back. When we leave this place, we'll want to be leaving fast and not have to wait for nobody.
Andrew's mouth was dry. He was glad there was no need for words because the tightness of his throat might not have let him speak. He sensed that Michael was counting under his breath.
Let's go.
Andrew was two paces ahead when they reached the backside of the hut. The man or men in the hut had probably gone to help fight the fires. At least, Andrew hoped so. The door was of woven grass, much like the rest of the hut. He grasped it and pulled. It came free, without a hinge. He rushed inside and for a moment felt blind in the darkness. The interior smelled heavily of smoke. The only light was a faint glow of coals in a stone circle at the hut's center.
Daniel, where are you at?
Over here!
Andrew saw Daniel lying on a blanket or a hide. He couldn't tell which. The boy tried to jump to his feet, but couldn't. Daniel's hands and feet were bound, and he was tethered to one of the tree limb braces that made up the hut's framework. A boy, larger than the others, rushed toward Daniel with a knife in his hand. Andrew tripped him and grabbed up the knife as the boy sprawled. He pitched it to Zeb and put his foot gently but firmly on the back of the boy's neck to hold him still. Zeb rushed to his brother. The blade flashed a reflection from the coals as he severed the tether and swept Daniel into his arms.
Daniel!
Zeb!
Let's get the hell out of here!
Andrew motioned for Zeb to leave first, carrying his brother. The woman dashed out the hut's front door, leaving the children behind.
Aruna! Aruna!
Andrew saw several pairs of bright eyes staring at him in fright from around the circular wall of the hut.
You all go back to bed.
Andrew lifted his foot from the bigger boy's neck. Michael stood at the east door through which they had entered. He made an impatient motion with his hand.
Will you hurry up?
Andrew went out ahead of him just in time to see an Indian man come running around the hut, grabbing at Zeb and the boy Daniel.
No!
Zeb turned quickly away, shielding his brother. Andrew saw a knife in the Indian's hand. He ran toward him.
Hey!
The man whipped around to face him. Andrew parried at him with the barrel of his rifle. The Indian stepped quickly aside, avoiding the thrust, then was on Andrew like a wildcat. The Indian was on top of him in an instant. Andrew let go of his rifle and used both hands to grab the Indian's wrist. The man was bigger and stronger. Inexorably, despite Andrew's best resistance, the knife blade was forced down toward his throat. He smelled the warrior's hot breath in his face. He felt the point bite into his skin. A dark form appeared above him. Michael swung his rifle. The man went limp, and Andrew quickly rolled out from under him. He grabbed the knife from the loosened fingers. He considered plunging it into the Indian's throat, as the warrior had tried to do to him.
I wish you wouldn't do it, but if you're going to, hurry up.
The impulse waned. Andrew stuck the Indian's knife in his belt and picked up his rifle.
Wouldn't be any gain in it.
Andrew moved into a trot, following Zeb and the boy back toward the river where Nathan and Fairweather held the horses. Michael followed Clovis, thoroughly aroused, fighting the fires, trying to prevent their spread. So far as he could tell, no one except those in the hut and the one who had jumped him knew that outsiders had passed so near. Harlan Mann fell in behind them, providing a rear guard.
The Lord be praised!
Only then did Zeb pause to cut the rest of the rawhide thongs that bound his brother.
Daniel, are you all right? They didn't hurt you.
They beat me some, but I hit them back every chance I got. The one you tripped, he was the worst.
Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord. Be content, my young friend.
Daniel plainly did not understand what Fairweather meant. Eli, Younce, and Smith rode up. Eli saw with satisfaction that the rescue had been made. He nodded toward the village.
Well, it'll be lucky if half the place don't burn the way the wind's getting up. I reckon they're too busy to be hunting us for a while.
Bright flash lighted the entire village.
It's fixing to rain, and that'll help them. We better be a long ways from here if they decide to come looking.
Zeb Willett mounted his horse, and Andrew boosted Daniel up behind him. Michael paused a moment to be sure everybody was in the saddle, then he heeled his bay horse into a run. The rest followed his pace. Their escape route led them past the horse herd. It would be easy to cut off several and drive them along, but Michael made no such move. Escape was the primary consideration now. Daniel pointed.
The pony's out there. They stole them.
You just hang on to your brother and ride like an Indian. I'll get you another pony someday.
They ran the horses as long as they dared. Michael slowed his bay to a trot and looked back to be sure none of the party had fallen behind. Giving Zeb and Daniel a look of satisfaction, he smiled for the first time.
Zeb, I wish we could have taken time to get your horses back.
Daniel's arms were around his older brother. Zeb patted one of the boy's arms.
I've got what counts. For this, I'd walk the rest of my life.
Michael pulled around to Andrew.
Looked to me like you were having a little trouble back there with that big Indian and his knife. He cut you?
Involuntarily, Andrew's hand went to his throat. In the excitement, he had put it out of his mind. It stung a little where the knife point had driven into the flesh.
Yeah, it was a long ways from the heart. It'll heal.
You didn't want me to come on this little sachet at all. I expect you're glad now that I did.
Andrew wanted to admit that he was, but he still felt that he'd been right. Michael's proper place had been with Marie. But where was the point in saying that now? He made no answer. The rain started, suddenly, with a vengeance, lashing at them as the lightning split the night skies. Andrew trembled at the chill and felt concerned for the boy, Daniel. But Zeb wrapped a blanket around his brother and kept riding.
After all he's been through, a little cold rain ain't gonna bother him much. He's a fighter. Papa'd be proud.
He'd be proud of both of you.
The water ran in rivulets down the gentle hills. Eli looked back and then down.
Whatever tracks we left behind us, this will wash them away. I doubt them Wakels will come after us in all this rain. If they commence later, they'll have a hell of a time finding a trace to start on.
The riders came to another heavy wood where tall pines formed an almost solid canopy overhead. This didn't stop the pounding rain from coming through, but it slowed the force.
We'll rest the horses and wait out the storm.
Might I suggest that perhaps we all go to our knees and offer up our gratitude to the Almighty for the safe delivery from the hands of our enemies.
Hats came off, even in the rain.
Amen.
Amen.
The men huddled in sodden misery beneath the trees, the cold offset somewhat by the warm success of their venture. Andrew sat on his heels, his back against a pine, and listened to various ones recount their personal memories of the raid on the village.
Joe here, he was so nervous he kept dropping his flint. I thought he never was going to get a fire started.
Ain't so tall. It was him that couldn't hold on to his flint. I got my fire started and had to go and help him with his. And I was the one that had to blow on it to keep it going. He was plumb out of wind.
You ain't never been out of wind.
Y'all both done yourselves proud.
Andrew suspected either one of them would be welcomed as a son-in-law to Miles Nathan, provided they didn't try to start soon. Bernie was young yet, even by frontier standards.
Everybody done themselves proud.
Michael brought his glance painfully to the one-eyed preacher.
Fairweather, I'll always remember what you did to us years ago, but I won't forget that you held up your part here, and more.
I have never asked even the Lord to forgive me for my past life. I've only asked for mercy.
The rain stopped at daylight. The men had little food left except for some jerked venison. They gave that to the boy. The parched grain substitute for coffee was gone, but the wood was so wet they probably couldn't have started a fire to boil it anyway. Hungry, tired, chilled, no one had to say anything about going home. Michael tightened the girth on his saddle and mounted the bay horse. The other men silently followed suit. Andrew was aware that they were retracing, more or less, the route they had taken on the way north. He guessed, but didn't ask, that Michael wanted to find the place where they had left Quentin Mann to be sure he'd managed to get on his horse and start home alone. They struck the river a little west of their original crossing and rode downstream. Andrew recognized the place where they had had their quick skirmish with the Indian boy. He knew the tree under which they had left Mann after the arrowhead had been removed from his leg. Mann was gone. Harlan Mann nodded in satisfaction.
I reckon Pa got to feeling stronger. He'll be home by now, with Ma taking care of him.
The rain had washed away whatever tracks man might have created. The river was on a slight rise, its waters an angry brown. But it was no obstacle to men on their way home from a long and bruising expedition that had challenged their endurance. They crossed over and set out southeastward, the way they'd come. Andrew guessed it was upward of noon when he saw a horse standing several hundred yards ahead of him, beneath an oak tree. Michael held up his hands as a signal for everybody to stop while he tried to decide if a lone horse out there so far from civilization might suggest any threat.
Anybody see something that I don't?
No one had anything to contribute. Michael proceeded, after checking his long rifle and pouring fresh powder into the pan. When they were within a couple of hundred yards, Harlan Mann suddenly looked grim.
Well, that looks like Pa's horse. Yes, sir, I believe it is.
A little nearer, Andrew could see a man lying on the ground.
Pa!
The rest of the men followed, but never caught up to him. When Andrew got there, Harlan was on the ground, kneeling before his fallen father. He saw at a glance at the wounded leg, swollen far beyond its normal size, and blowflies had found it. The stench made his stomach turn. Michael dismounted quickly and handed his reins to Zeb Willett. Andrew did likewise. Eli stayed in the saddle, but looked down sadly.
Is he dead?
Andrew felt for the man's pulse. He saw a man's eyelids flutter. Man blinked a few times, trying to see. He picked out his son and painfully brought him into some focus.
Harlan?
It's me, Pa. I'm here.
Oh. I tried to wait, but the leg... Tell your mama...
That was all he managed to say. The pulse weakened gradually, and finally it was gone. Man had waited for his son. Once Harlan had come, he had no strength left for holding on any longer.
I'm sorry, Harlan.
To everything, there is a season.
Young Harlan man bit his lip.
Time.
Will you all help me put him on his horse? I'll take him home now.
Time to be born, and the time to die. The time to plan. Time to pluck up that which is planted. Time to eat, and time to laugh. Lord, we commend this man into your hands. Take him to his heavenly rest, and bless his family with comfort in their grief. Amen.
Fairweather watched as man's body was tied securely to his saddle.
Thank you.
I'll go home with you, son. Your mama will feel better if there's somebody to read the words over him right and proper.
The others sat on their horses and watched with bowed heads as Harlan and Fairweather started their solitary journey, angling almost due east toward the man home on the Brazos.
Two dead on our side and two dead on theirs. Kinda evens everything up, don't it?
Nobody spoke for a minute.
This Texas, it has a world of promise, but it sure asks a hell of a toll.
They were a tired, bedraggled, bewhiskered, and hungry group as they limped in, finally, to the Willett farm. Andrew's shoulders were slumped. His backside felt numb from the long, weary ride. They had managed to shoot one deer on the way back, a small doe that was more flavor than substance, and certainly not large enough to satisfy everybody's need. They had given the boy the best of it. During the trip, he described his treatment as a captive of the Indians. Often he had been confused because he didn't understand their language, and they tended to whip him when he didn't respond as they wished him to.
Most of the time, I didn't know what they wanted me to do. But even when I knowed, I acted like I didn't. The one you was wrestling with, Andrew, he acted like he was wanting to make a slave out of me. One time he hit me, I got a hold of his hand and bit him good. I never did know which one was the one that killed Papa.
It don't matter anymore. Getting you home to Mama and them
fatigued
is all that counts.
Though
now.
They were, the two young Willets seemed to gain new strength as they came in sight of the spread-out, comfortable-looking log structure Lige Willett had built for his family on the farm which was to have been his home into his old age, the place to watch his children grow up and to raise the grandchildren who would have brightened his final years. Andrew felt a catch in his throat, looking at the place, at the field which Willett would never harvest again, at the young orchard from which he would never taste the fruit. It had always been a joy to come over here and sit a spell with the Willets and their brood. It would never be the same again. He felt the loss more now than when he had first heard of Willett's death. He saw a number of horses being herded on grass a quarter mile from the house, guarded by two riders still unwilling to discount the threat of Indians. The horses belonged to the settler families who had gathered here for mutual protection. Several wagons stood near the shed. Lige Willett had not owned one. The riders were seen long before they reached the cabin. More than a dozen people poured out onto the dog run and into the open yard, waiting.
Yonder's Mama!
Zeb couldn't restrain himself. Andrew blinked as he recognized Mrs. Willett, hurrying out to meet her sons. Zeb handed the boy down to her. She clasped him in her arms as if she would crush the life from him. Zeb slowly dismounted. When she looked up at him, he went to her, and the three of them stood there, holding on to one another. At the distance, Andrew could not hear if anything was being said, but he doubted that words were necessary. An excited crowd gathered around the Willett family, offering congratulations for the boy's return. Miles Nathan went to his own family, his wife reaching out for him. The two bachelors, Younce and Smith, gave their full attention to the Nathan girl, Birdie. Andrew saw Michael's eyes brighten and a smile break across his whiskered face. Andrew followed his gaze, though he didn't have to. He knew who Michael had been searching for. Andrew watched as Michael swept Marie into his arms. Young Mordecai grabbed his father's legs and held tightly. Only Andrew and Eli remained on their horses, on the edge of the crowd, but somehow not a part of it. Eli must have read the emptiness in Andrew's face.
It's hard going sometimes, being a bachelor.
Andrew looked away, his eyes burning. He had never felt more alone. In later years, the incident would be remembered grandiosely as the Fredonian Rebellion, and some would claim it was the earliest glimmering of the Texas Revolution against Mexico. It began with a brashly confrontational Kentuckian named Hayden Edwards, one of many land empresarios who attempted to bring in American settlers and established colonies in Mexican Texas after the pattern set by Stephen F. Austin. Most failed, but few did so with the bluster and bitterness and legacy of official mistrust that marred Edwards' brief career as an empire builder. The fault was not his alone. Much of it was rooted in the inefficiency and carelessness of bureaucracy, granting him lands upon which others had prior claim, including Mexican citizens who had lived there for generations, peaceful Indians who considered it theirs by birthright, and even Americans who claimed squatters' rights by virtue of having survived years of futile efforts by the Spanish and Mexican governments to push them back across the Sabine River. Andrew had little inkling of the future trend of events when he encountered Edwards' brother Benjamin that summer. He didn't go often to Michael's cabin, for the rift that had broken between them had not healed. He wouldn't have gone at all if it hadn't been for his need to look in occasionally upon Marie and the boy Mordecai. He kept himself busy on his own place and tried not to dwell upon the loneliness of it. Eli Pleasant had stayed only a little while, then drifted back toward Nacogdoches and his own place just across the Sabine in Louisiana. One morning, working in the field, Andrew caught a movement on the horizon and stopped the blue-speckled ox. He wiped sweat from his forehead and eyes and squinted. He saw a lone rider, evidently a stranger, because Andrew didn't recognize the mount. He knew every horse between here and San Felipe just about, and could identify them from farther away than he could identify their riders. The horseman was coming from the direction of San Antonio de Bar, the Mexican capital of Texas.
Oh, he's had him right smart of a ride.
Andrew wondered at first if this might be Stephen Austin, for Austin often traveled to Bar to conduct business with representatives of the Mexican government. But as the distance lessened, it was evident this was a larger man than Austin. The rider was well-dressed for a man on the road, though dusty and trail-worn. He didn't look at all like a farmer. Andrew took him for a lawyer. The man stared with much interest at Andrew's cabin, at his field, at the ox in the yoke.
I must say, I am glad to see a sign of civilization. I had feared for some time I had lost my way.
You're going the right way if you're headed for San Felipe.
Andrew strode forward and offered his grimy hand.
Name's Andrew Lewis. Give me time to unhook the ox, I'll go with you into the cabin and fix us a bite of dinner.
The man dismounted and accepted the hand, dirt and all.
Benjamin Edwards. Perhaps you have heard of my brother, Hayden Edwards?
I don't get away from this place much. If you ask me who is President of the United States, I might get it wrong.
My brother is an impresario like Stephen Austin. No, not like Austin. Better.
It occurred to Andrew, now that he thought about it, that Eli had said something to him about an Edwards who was making a claim to land around Nacogdoches. If he remembered right, Eli had said there was trouble over the titles. but it would be impolite to bring up such a disagreeable subject with a chance passerby.
The fare won't be fancy, but it'll be filling. I left a pot of beans on the coals this morning, and there's venison.
They went to the pens first, where he forked a little hay to the ox and slid a bar in place so the animal couldn't leave. If the visitor didn't stay long, Andrew could get a lot more work done in the field before dark. While he fried venison in the little fireplace, he asked about conditions in Bar, a place he'd always found somehow fascinating.
Poorest town I ever saw in my life. Mexicans, mostly. And no real cash money among the lot of them. They think poor and they live poor. What they need is some good American energy to bring that place to life.
Always seemed an agreeable bunch of people to me. Gotten along with them well enough.
Andrew saw that Edwards' feeling was deeply held. It was bad form to argue with a guest, especially when he saw so few of them. He put the food on the table.
Go on, help yourself.
Edwards fell silent, putting away two men's share of the venison, beans, and rough ground cornbread. The trail from Bar was long. At last, Edwards pushed his chair back from the crude table and rubbed his stomach in contentment.
Plain and humble fare, my friend, but filling enough to do me until I reach a better place.
Glad you liked it.
The beans should have lasted Andrew 3 or 4 days. They wouldn't now.
If your colony's up in Nacogdoches, what brings you all the way to Bar in San Felipe?
The stupidity of government. They gave us our grant, and now they say there's difficulty over titles. There are squatters on our land who resist our efforts to move them. And the central government has been no help. On the contrary, it has been a major part of the problem. I went to Bar to apprise the authorities of the true situation and to let them know exactly where my brother and I stand. I told them most forcefully that an agreement is an agreement. Sometimes, however, these Mexicans are like children. One must take a firm position with them. Show them that an American is not to be trifled with.
Andrew felt a stirring of concern. Edwards' manner told him the man had done a lot of telling and very little asking. As little experience as Andrew had had with Mexican authorities, he knew their pride did not respond well to lecturing by a foreigner. Lecturing had never been Stephen Austin's style, one reason he'd gotten along so well. He was a diplomat. Had he not been, no American would now be in Texas legally, and perhaps not illegally either. Stirred up, the Mexicans, like the Spanish before them, had a most severe manner of dealing with trespassers upon their ground. Somewhere up toward Nacogdoches, Mordecai Lewis's unmarked grave bore silent testimony to that fact.
Just what was it you told the authorities?
I told them they had granted my brother that land, and if the central government did not expel the interlopers, we would do it ourselves without their assistance.
Mexicans don't appreciate being talked to like that.
Oh, by the eternal, sir. They listened with rapt attention.
I bet they did.
You find fault with me, sir?
There's people in Mexico hunting for any excuse to get rid of all of us Americans that have taken up land on Mexican soil. Every time Austin deals with them, he acts like a man walking on eggshells. Feller like you goes to stirring him up. He's apt to make trouble for all of us.
I did no more than stand up for my rights, mine and my brother's. If I stepped on any sore toes, they should not have been stuck out in the way. I am going now to San Felipe to apprise Mr. Austin of what has been done and said. If there is to be trouble, I shall expect him, as an American, to stand with us.
It was in Andrew's mind that Austin would not be pleased by this report. But Austin was plenty capable of speaking for himself. Andrew had no need to speak for him. Edwards walked to the door and gave Andrew's farm a long study.
We have better land at Nacogdoches, and much closer to a civilized country.
I've seen it.
Edwards could take any inference he wished from that.
I'm satisfied right where I'm at.
And are you satisfied with Austin? He's much too thick with the Mexicans to suit me.
I count him as a friend of mine.
Very well. Time will tell which of us is right. I am obliged for the meal, sir.
Welcome anytime.
Andrew watched Edwards ride toward Michael's cabin and made a dry, humorless smile as he thought how much better meal the man could have eaten if he'd gone there first and had sat at Marie's table instead of Andrew's. Well, he probably deserved about what he got. He put the yoke on the ox and took him back to the field. He tried to put Edwards out of his mind, but couldn't. He kept remembering Austin's concern over keeping friendly relations with the Mexican authorities. The American settlers in Texas could look to no one but each other for help if the radicals in Mexico gained enough influence to try to put them off the land. A few blustering bullies like Edwards could spoil the fragile alliances that held American Texas together and bring catastrophe down upon everyone. Ever since he had seen the surveyors, Isaac Blackwood had expected trouble. The Blackwood family had been squatters for generations, so they dreaded surveyors as they dreaded Indians. The lawyers would not be far behind, and eviction was sure to follow. It had been that way since Grandpap's time, way back in the Appalachians. Finnis had taken up his rifle to kill the surveyors, and Luke backed him, as always. Isaac had argued that missing men draw searchers, and it was hard to hide a killing, especially that of several men. Finnis had maintained that they could throw suspicion onto the Cherokee Indians who lived in the general vicinity. Isaac had managed to convince him that the Cherokees were regarded as civilized, and the authorities in Nacogdoches would not long be fooled.
All right, but there better not be no strapped britches son of a bitch come and try to run us off our place. I'll kill him deader than a skint mule.
The Mexican soldiers who had captured them at the Lewis farm had conducted them first to Nacogdoches for examination by the civil authorities, then to the bank of the Sabine. The troops had waited in ominous silence while the Blackwoods swam their horses across to Louisiana. Isaac would have been content to squat on the Louisiana side, where the laws at least were American. But Finnis had his hard head set on Texas and satisfaction from Michael Lewis. He couldn't do it sitting on the east side of the Sabine in Frenchman country. They had waited until nightfall, then sneaked back into Texas in the dark of the moon. So now they bided their time at a place they had found abandoned on a small creek in a clearing in the midst of a heavy East Texas piney wood. Isaac surmised that some squatter before them had built the small cabin and had broken the ground for a field a little larger than a garden. He had probably been driven out by Spanish or Mexican soldiers, or perhaps simply by starvation. The field seemed to grow rocks better than it grew anything Isaac had planted. It had one virtue, however: proximity to the Sabine River and quick escape into Louisiana in the event Isaac's brothers followed their natural propensities for mischief and a hasty departure for the United States became necessary. He paused to lean on the hoe and wipe a sleeve across his face to stop the burning sweat from trailing down into his eyes. The tall green corn stalks rustled around him, intercepting much of the breeze that might have blown cool through his half-soaked shirt. He looked about for his brothers. Luke sat in the shade beside the log cabin, sagging on a rough bench like a sack of cornmeal. He looked all tuckered out, but he was just lazy. He'd spent perhaps half an hour helping Isaac hoe weeds out of the corn, then had quit the work. Isaac didn't see Finnis anywhere, but he had a good notion his oldest brother was in the cabin, and not alone. Once Finnis had found a woman who would tolerate him, he was rutting like an acorn-fed boar. They'd discovered neighbors a few miles to the south, squatters like themselves, who had no official sanction to be in Texas, but probably were unwanted anywhere else. Or perhaps they were wanted by one sheriff or another. Among their numerous brood was a plump and red-headed daughter, Nellie, 20 years old, not much for looks, but a fair to middling cook and housekeeper, and perfectly willing to take up with Finnis Blackwood. Her folks had seemed relieved to see her go, though they had acted a little put out that no money went with the deal. They had made no fuss about the lack of clerical blessing. Mentally, Nellie was about on the same level as Luke, certainly no bragging point. What made her attractive to Finnis was that she seemed perpetually in heat. Finnis had first claim, but when he was in a better-than-average mood, he lent her to Luke. When the two happened to be gone off hunting, Nellie would rub up against Isaac. Sometimes he resisted, and sometimes he accepted her invitation. He was not proud of it. But he had been doing most of the work around here and getting damn little of the pleasure Finnis owed him. With all that planting being done, it seemed a foregone conclusion that a crop would sprout one of these days, and nobody would know whose it was. From the corner of his eye, Isaac caught a movement at the edge of the wood. He paused only a moment before dropping his hoe and trotting to the end of the row where he'd propped his rifle against a log. He saw three horsemen. They wore no uniform, so at least they weren't Mexican soldiers. But strangers always had a way of bringing bad news. First the surveyors, then the lawyers. It had been that way forever, seemed like. Isaac trotted to the cabin.
Luke! Luke! You lazy bastard! Wake up and grab your rifle!
Isaac pushed open the cabin door, and as he expected, he saw Finnis on the bed, all tangled up with Nellie.
What the hell?
You better get your britches on and fetch your rifle. Looks like we got company coming.
Who is it?
I don't know, but you can bet they ain't here to bring us no money.
Nellie tried to cover herself with the blanket as Finnis quit the bed. It didn't matter. Isaac had seen all there was, more than once. He went outside and took up a station in front of the cabin, rifle cradled across his arm. Luke moved up beside him.
I can pick off one of them and you can get another. Finnis will get the last one before he makes the timber.
Shooting at people's the way Finnis lost his arm, or have you forgot?
The three riders were not lawyers. They were too sun-browned and weather-creased to have spent their lives in a courtroom. But Isaac figured no lawyers would get out this far from the settlements anyway. They would send somebody who worked cheaper. These three had the dour look of the lawmen Isaac and his brothers had encountered all over Tennessee, carrying out the orders of the landed gentry and the merchant class. The biggest among them leaned forward in his saddle, his gaze running from Isaac to Luke to Finnis, who would finally come out with breeches unbuttoned and no shirt or boots.
You folks just passing through here, I hope.
I was hoping the same about you all.
We represent Hayden Edwards, who has permission of the Mexican government to settle 800 families. He has posted legal notice in Nacogdoches that all who have a prior claim are to present proof to him of their legal presence here or vacate the region immediately.
We ain't seen it. We ain't been to Nacogdoches.
I have a copy of his order if you want to read it.
The man reached into a saddlebag. Luke quickly hoisted his rifle to his shoulder. The man paused in ill-suppressed alarm.
I'm just going after the paper is all.
Stand easy, Luke.
Luke paid him no attention, looking instead to Finnis.
Let him, Luke. We can kill him afterwards.
The document looked official, but Isaac had never made much sense out of such things. Finnis and Luke couldn't read at all.
A man can write down anything he wants to. That don't make it so. We found this place. Wasn't nobody using it. We claim squatters' rights.
The man gave him a long, cautious stare.
There's no such thing. You have no right to be on this property.
We got a right. We got it right here.
Finnis shifted his rifle to his shoulder and took aim at the man on the horse.
You want to come a little closer and see?
The man glanced at the riders on either side of him for reassurance. Neither had moved. His face flushed a little.
Mr. Edwards is fully prepared to take the case to the Mexican authorities. You will find yourselves in court.
We've been in court before. Ain't never been no judge's hammer come down as hard as the hammer on this rifle.
The horseman pulled up on his bridle reins. Isaac saw fear in his eyes, a fear that was more than justified. If Finnis took it in his head to shoot, he would. He had never been one to dwell upon consequences. Isaac wanted to tell Finnis to back off a little, but that might have seemed a weakening of their stand, giving strength to the visitors. He knew if Finnis killed this one, he and Luke would have to finish the other two. They couldn't let any of the men leave here alive unless all three did.
Might I inquire your gentlemen's names?
is Smith.
If the squatters we found are named Smith.
We got a lot of kin folks. Now, y'all have more than wore out your welcome. The trail you use coming in here is the best one to use going out.
The three riders glanced at each other and seemed to agree that they had business elsewhere.
There will be more to this!
If I was you, I'd forget how to find this place!
As the men rode away, Luke lowered his rifle, but Finnis still held his aim, bracing the long barrel with the stump of an arm. Isaac reached out and pulled the muzzle toward the ground.
I got a mind to kill that son of a bitch. He ain't out of range yet.
Then we'd have to leave anyway. What's the sense in that?
Isaac knew the way to deflect Finnis's attention from the three riders was to draw it to himself. He gave Finnis a quick study from his tousled black hair down to his bare feet.
Hell of a sight you are. Wonder they didn't laugh themselves to death.
Ain't nobody laughs at me. Not but once.
Isaac pointed his chin toward the tiny field.
The corn needs hoeing, and I can't keep up with the weeds all by myself. Why don't you put the rest of your clothes on and come help me?
Ain't much I can do with one arm.
I expect Nellie'd disagree about that.
Finnis looked quickly toward the cabin as if he had forgotten she was there.
I'll be out directly, but don't expect me to do much.
Isaac turned to Luke.
What about you?
Luke's mind was not on the field.
Well, Finnis is with her right now.
Isaac shrugged with a sense of futility and let his gaze go back to the three horsemen, disappearing where the trail turned into the woods. They would be back. Maybe not for a week, maybe not for a month. He wondered what he would do when they returned, for there would probably be more of them next time. The damn place wasn't really worth fighting over anyway, but fight he would if it came to that, because he was a Blackwood. And he would probably lose. Because he was a Blackwood.